Well, hello there. Thank you for joining us. On today's episode, Bob and I talk about the movie Chinatown. Written by Robert Towne, directed by Roman Polanski, starring Jack Nicholson. Some regard it as the best noir film ever made. Others argue that it doesn't fit the noir genre. Nonetheless, it's a great film. If you have yet to see it, this is a must-see. The late John Huston, known for directing his share of noir movies, gives a chilling performance as Noel Cross, a very rich and powerful man in Los Angeles set in the 1930s. Nicholson plays a private eye who gets swept away in murder, deceit, and corruption. It's just a great movie, and this is basically what we had to say. All right, Bob. So let's start by just getting a general idea of what you thought about the movie overall, real quick.
I had never seen this movie before.
Okay.
And of course, I've always seen it on Netflix, and I kind of was like, it's, I don't know, dudes in hats. I don't know. I just from the thumbnails, I didn't know what to expect.
It didn't appeal to
it didn't.
Bob.
It didn't. Even though Jack Nicholson in it, but I was like, just whatever. But honestly, when you gave me the assignment, I actually watched this movie at work because it was slow at work, and it was a really good movie. I didn't expect to be that good.
Yeah,
I actually almost feel cheated not knowing how good that was.
A lot of people don't know how good that movie is. I mean, that's why we're talking about it today.
Yeah. And if you haven't seen it, go watch it, you know.
Yeah.
Chinatown, 1974, Roman Polanski.
Worth checking out for sure.
Yeah, worth checking out. And of course, honestly, and it's not one of those movies where you could actually like, oh, I'm going to do something in the background and just have it, because you're not going to get anything done. It has to be, if you don't pay attention to it, it's almost one of those movies where if you miss a part of it, you're not going to understand the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
Because every, the movie kind of, like I said, it builds upon itself.
Right.
Compared to, like, I guess any other movie, if you watch any kind of, like, modern movie now, you could just guess what happens. Like, oh, is that what happened?
Yeah.
Oh, that's exactly what happened. No, this is not one of those movies.
No.
If you miss one part, you're not going to understand the rest of the movie. And eventually you'll get back, maybe you'll figure it out. But it's just one of those movies that builds upon itself. And when it finally, it reaches that climax, that top, and it just all the way down, just screaming.
It's a dark movie. It's a really dark movie.
It is.
I do consider it to be one of the top noir movies. And a lot of people think it isn't because it breaks a lot of noir themes. If you guys want to know more about noir, obviously, check out movies like The Big Sleep, old P.I., Philip Marlowe type detective stories like The Long Goodbye is another good one.
I kind of want to say that maybe noir movies, maybe they would have been darker if censorship in America hadn't been like as it was, kind of thing. Because honestly, like granted now wouldn't be never shown back in the day. So maybe the movies would have been darker. And, it would have broken into more tropes, but they had to kind of follow this kind of narrow, rigid thing because they couldn't pass the censors. But, of course, 1974, we didn't have any of that, so.
Yeah, if you watch The Big Sleep, there's a lot of things, because it's based on a Raymond Chandler novel, mm-hmm. which I recently started reading. And the Raymond Chandler book is way more explicit compared to the movie, but you could tell it's implied.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you watch that movie, I won't get deep into it. But these dark undertones are already applied. I think this was the first time that they said, you know what?
Let's go. Let's all 18 wheels. Let's just go.
Let's just go. Yeah. And they did it. And they went a little bit further, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would say extremely further. But, the reason I wanted to talk about this movie is because the movie has great, amazing writing. And has basically takes the noir genre and just kind of messes with it. You know, kind of like you were saying earlier.
I wouldn't say mess with it. I would say it did put, there's a little bit of nitrous in the tank. It decided,
there you go. Yeah.
It's just a regular car ride, but let's put this pep, you know, turn it up to 11. Because like I said, they went for dark movies.
Yeah.
And they're just like, no, we could go darker. Let's go. And of course, if you watch the movie, you're just like, oh man, there's it starts off as just when the beginning of the movie, it shows a guy named Curly, and he hired Jack Nicholson to go spy on his wife because she's screwing around with him.
Yeah.
And it's pictures of just her and another man in different positions, and he's just and you can tell he's getting upset. He's really upset.
Uh-huh.
And then he's just like, oh, and then he's like, starts like messing, and he goes, hey, don't mess with the blinds. I had it installed next Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. He's well, that's the snarkiness.
Yeah.
That's kind of typical PI stuff. But it's funny that they put that scene in there, because traditional PIs, they don't want to deal with any marriage issues. They just, that's like something that they don't mess with. And this guy, opening scene, he's already uncovering.
But honestly, in real life, like I said, of course, we're talking about censorship. Censorship, like, oh, we can't talk about infidelities. And, you know, like, honestly, like I said, 1974, they didn't give a rat's ass.
Oh, no.
And not to mention PIs, that's probably most of their cases are just infidelity, because that's just the way people are. And, of course, Curly goes. And, of course, like I was talking to you about this earlier, like one of my favorite parts of the movie, whereas a little later in the movie, they catch up to Curly because Jack Nicholson is trying to lose the police.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes to Curly's house, and Curly's wife opens the door, and she has a shiner, like a big shiner. And he's like, oh, hello, is Curly here? And Curly is just like, they're having dinner with the family.
He's like, not everything's like, yeah, oh,
just
yeah,
everything's fine.
Have a little dinner, have a seat.
You know, a little spousal abuse. You know, it's cool.
Yeah.
Of course, this is back in the times are different. Times are different.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Of course, I guess that's, I don't want to say that's the toll she paid to, like, you know, but yeah, they didn't.
They didn't hide away from.
No, they didn't. I mean, granted, she could have just gone to the door and she not have a shiner. But honestly, like I said, that's what makes this movie, the layers of the movie, the fact that, yeah, we knew, you know, especially imagine if they just started off with supposed Mrs. Mulray just saying, hey, by the way, I think my husband's cheating on me, without actually putting that first part. Because like I said, that's. Actually, the rest of that movie wouldn't make any sense if they didn't actually put it in the part, because he wouldn't actually like known Curly. Oh, it's just some guy he knows, and his wife's got a black eye.
There you go. Yeah. It's roped really nicely in. Another thing about that is when she does come in, the first, we'll call her the first Miss Mulray, he just got done with one of these cases, and you can just tell he's just kind of like, oh, man. Yeah. Like, you're better off not knowing.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, you're better off not knowing. He's just kind of being very sarcastic towards her.
You ever heard of the term "let sleeping dogs lie"?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. No, that was a great scene. And of course, she's like, "No, money's no object." And honestly, like, there's, granted, he's probably tired of cheating spouses cases. But honestly, if a rich lady is doing it, you know, you might as that's
she's paying.
That's what paying the bills, obviously. Of course, the rest of the scene is him like following Mulray,
which brings into obviously the bigger the other layer of the onion, I guess you could say,
mm-hmm.
where it's talking about the California water system. He's a water commissioner, and so this kind of sends him down the rabbit hole, which is what most noir movies tend to do. It's never just a simple case. Obviously, it's something bigger.
And it is a huge issue, because like honestly, like they talk about you know, he followed him around. He's like, he's not doing anything wrong. He's just he's got water on the brain. That's all he does. Like I said, he's, you know, at late at night looking at drainage pipes that have water in them. Suddenly
he's a water commissioner. I mean, yeah. What do you expect?
He's meeting up with people at night. Which actually, that was a pretty cool. I didn't understand what was going on. He had in his glove box, he had a bunch of those cheap watches. Like, of course,
That was cool.
Yeah, and then, of course, he sticks it on the door. And when that guy left, you know,
he saw the time he left.
The watch broke.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, like, oh, that's really cool. That's, I guess.
Because when he's popped the in his car, he reaches in and he's like, why does he have so many watches?
Yeah, he's got, that's weird.
And this is like a regular thing he does. Yeah.
And, you know, he's good at what he does.
He's good at what he does.
He's good at what he does.
And here's something that I wanted to point out. He gives this this advice to the first Miss Mulray, the fake one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't take it himself, if you think about it, because at any point, he could have just stopped and said, you know what, okay, I'm done with this. Especially,
could, really? Could you think you would have stopped?
Well, here's the thing.
Okay.
When...
Oh.
What'd you break?
I broke my little hamstring.
Oh, man.
Thing.
Look, Mr. Superman over here.
He's like, yeah, don't mess with me. I broke my 80-pound hamstring thinner.
There you go.
Bear witness to my strength.
All right. So, here's the idea. When the real Miss Mulray comes in, and... Because he, you know, he blew it up. He went to the papers. He took a picture with...
I think he what happened was he took the pictures,
mm-hmm.
and he delivered them like he's supposed to.
Right.
And she, the fake Mrs. Mulray,
right.
she delivered them to the, you know...
To the paper.
To the paper. Because honestly, that was the whole thing.
Right.
Like Norcross. You know, of course, after you find out that, after you kind of go down the rabbit hole, you find out that his partner was trying to ruin his reputation by doing that. So he would build this, the stupid dam, whatever, which he refused to do because, honestly, of that tragedy of the... I forget what the name of the tragedy is, but he tried to build the dam before.
And it broke, and
it killed 500 people.
Yeah.
And, of course, like, that guy was just trying to
trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And so whoever, so the guy who had Miss Mulray, all that fiasco, what ends up happening is the real Mulray comes, Miss Mulray comes down, and she's ready to sue this guy. And that's when he's kind of like, oh, man, like, I've been set up kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I need to do something about it. He could have just said, you know what? I'm just going to let it go, especially when he went towards her to talk to her for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
She said, you know what? You're fine. I'll drop the case.
Well, that's because of the fact that she realized, especially with a hard-headed detective like he was.
He's going to find things out.
He's going to find things out, and he does. That's,
he does.
Yeah, the fact that she doesn't understand that that's all he does. That's what he's good for.
Yeah.
But, of course... there's no way he didn't understand the complexity of the whole case. Because honestly, like, what it boiled down to was just pretty much just a rape case. But honestly, but before all that, you were thinking it was just some giant municipal bond fraud, basically.
Which is part of it, but I mean, that's it just has a lot of layers.
Well, honestly, that's the thing about it. That whole thing, that was just... that was just something we just happened to see on the ride.
Yeah.
You know, that had actually really nothing to do with this. Not the main thing.
She's trying to hide.
Yeah. But honestly, but the gravity of that situation drug everybody into that, you know.
Right.
How could it not?
Exactly. So here's the thing. Typically, with these PI detectives, they're critical thinkers. They know, you know, something's up. She comes back and I guess I forget what's the reason she comes back to finally say, you know what, can you work on this case to see who killed my husband? Because she comes back and then she's really nervous when he starts questioning about her father, because she keeps like bringing up the cigarettes and he's like, or do you get, you know.
You know, yeah, no, I remember that part. That was...
Because he kind of opens it up and says, you know what, your husband was murdered. He goes to the coroner, they say it was salt water, and he's kind of questioning and say, like, well, how was it salt water?
He was supposedly drowned in a freshwater, like, ditch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In dry Los Angeles. So he's like, no, man, I'm not gonna let this slide. Like, this is clearly a murder, and I'm gonna figure this out. So he goes and kind of pushes her and says, "You know what? Your husband was murdered." And initially, the first time, she's kind of like, I want you to drop the case, whatever. And that's when he's kind of like thinking, like, what the hell is going on?
Well, honestly, that's so, because honestly, you initially thought she killed her husband.
Yeah,
honestly.
Absolutely.
And of course,
because he's with a nice little woman, I guess.
Yeah.
Out boating, doing things.
That was one of my favorite scenes, by the way. Like, he was just kind of like, Jack Nicholson, he was in his prime back then.
Yeah,
like,
he was.
Man, he was just there, just smoking a cigarette, just like, hey, let me take a picture of you, and starts taking a picture of his partner.
Yeah.
And that was just a, like, I don't know,
that was a classic scene.
That was a classic scene. That was a great scene.
Exactly. And
But basically, she was, if anything, she might have been just a, I guess she might thought of, if she might have paid him off, he might have just dropped it. Which
didn't happen.
No, it didn't happen, because honestly, you can't keep a good man down, obviously.
Exactly. Which brings me to the next part. Now he's digging, and he ends up going to another water reservoir, and that's when Roman Polanski's cameo appears, and he's the guy. He's like, who's the midget? He's the midget.
Oh, he's the midget. He's the guy who actually like cut Jack Nicholson's nose.
His nose, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like a little cool thing, and you could tell these are like subtle nods to like Alfred Hitchcock. Because Alfred Hitchcock did a lot of these noir-type movies, but he kind of turned them upside down. Because, you know, I'm going to do these movies, but I'm doing it my way. And it's kind of what Roman Polanski is kind of doing. He's kind of ripping off of Alfred Hitchcock a little bit. He's kind of doing his own spin on the noir genre.
Mm-hmm.
So for him to do a cameo is definitely like something that Alfred Hitchcock would do, because he would do a bunch of cameos back in the day. So I thought that was pretty cool. And the whole nose thing, just the imagery of him walking around with, you know, his nose.
What did you do to yourself? I cut myself shaving.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was good. Of course, granted, that whole scene, that made me mad, that whole scene. Because, like, he just kind of notches. And then you actually see the damage that he actually just notched his nostril all the way up.
Yeah.
And, the thing is, I also thought that was kind of a thing. The fact that's probably one of the reasons why it drives Jack Nicholson's character.
Yeah.
The fact that it's now personal. The fact that of course, granted, I would have went back and found the midget and shot the midget, but maybe they just did things in the 40s.
Well, because he knows, you know, he knows he needs to get to the bottom of it. This is bigger than he expected. Now he just wants to uncover it. He wants to expose it for what it is. I mean, this is a guy that has morals, and, you know, he's been working on these crappy civil cases they doesn't necessarily care about, and he used to be a police officer, and obviously got rubbed out for being, quote-unquote, too nosy, right? Because, you know, it's a lot of corruption.
Chinatown.
Yeah, it's Chinatown. So you can tell that he's been through that kind of numerous times, especially when he's in the car with the detectives, and they're like, come on, didn't you learn the first time? You know, they're kind of telling him, like, dude, learn your lesson, let it go. But you can tell this is a righteous guy, someone that wants to do good, which is the PI detective thing, which goes back to the overall story. It's a detective that wants to do good. He wants to uncover the truth, but in order to do that, he has to lie. He has to manipulate himself through, you know, a barrage of places that he's not supposed to be. You know what I mean? So that is always interesting to me, where you have you're questioning the morality of actions for people. Like, okay, he's doing the right thing, but in order to do the right thing, you have to do all these bad things. You know?
Well, honestly, and it goes back to the old saying, if you want an omelet, you have to break a few eggs.
Yeah.
Because honestly, and that's what he does. And unfortunately, telling the truth doesn't get, you know, like, and there's plenty of times in the movie where he lies, where he just straight out lies. But honestly, it's a small price to pay to, you know, get the better vantage point. And of course, that's where he found out, you know, like, the first time where I was talking to you before about where, not Mr. Mulroy's partner. I don't remember what his name is, but Mr. Mulroy's partner, and he steals a bunch of those business cards. Mm-hmm. Of course, I didn't understand what his
cross.
No, that's Nora Cross. I was talking about the
his dad,
the guy with the mustache. He has the office right next to him. I remember he goes to Mr. Mulready's office, and he has the office across from there.
Oh, Higgins.
Higgins, is that what his name is?
From Magnum PI.
Yeah. And
that's what I'll call
Oh, yeah, the guy from that guy. And like he goes like, "Oh, can I borrow some of your business cards just in case, or can I have a business card?"
Yeah.
See if I, you know, if I need to contact you. And he takes a whole like stack of them.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's kind of odd. And of course, the next scene is him driving up to the ditch, and him telling the officer, "Oh, by the way, I'm from Water and Power." And of course, he just lets him like, "Bye."
Yeah.
And it's just like, no, I would have never been that smart or devious, clever to think of that. That's.
Oh man, I love when he goes to that same office. And he goes, "Oh, he's not in." And he's like, "Oh, okay, I'll just wait in his office." And he just like
starts, yeah, just
in there.
"Oh, he's early. I'll just go and wait in his office and just start looking around for shit." Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And then the next time she thinks she's smart, she goes, "He's tied up in meetings." And he's like, "Okay, I have an hour lunch break."
Yeah, sometimes all day. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he just starts perusing around. And then finally she's like, "Oh," because he starts asking questions, and he just gets flustered, and he's like, "All right, he's ready to see you now." He's like, "Oh, okay," but then he's already been digging information, got some from her.
The fact that he's already, just for him being in that office, he already uncovered because he finds out that Faye Dunaway's character, her name is Cross, and then he finds out Nora Cross is also, so he realizes the connection between her and the water company, and just. You know, just for him being in the
And that there's a falling out.
Yeah, there's a falling out. They don't know why. There was an argument. Of course, you just think it was just about the water thing, about the whole the dam thing. But you find it, no, it's much more personal.
Yeah.
Much more devious.
Which we'll get to in a little bit.
Yeah.
Going back to the secretary.
Okay.
Just think about her life. She's just like, you know, I wonder what she was thinking the whole time. It's just a regular day. You know, this guy came in annoying her. He's like, goes home. Guess what? This freaking a-hole.
Well, no, I wouldn't even say that. Like, one of my, I guess, supervisors or one of the guys, my boss was murdered. Now I have this detective looking around.
Yeah.
You know, looking, you know.
Perusing,
you know, looking for stuff. He was in his office looking for stuff. I don't know what he's doing in there. I could lose my job kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
I just always think about...
Because you don't think about anybody else. You just think about yourself.
Right? Just my selfish thoughts. No, but I always like to kind of think about these random characters that are in there. You know, they're still... They have their own little story within the story kind of thing.
Well, like Curly. Like, just the fact that, you know, he was just a regular schmuck, and he probably doesn't have enough money to actually afford to pay off.
Yeah.
You know, of course, that's why he helps Jack Nicholson carry the lid, because he doesn't have the money to pay him off for the thing.
Yeah, he kind of gives him, he's like, "Look, you don't have to pay me. In fact, I'll throw in 20 or 40 bucks.
How about 75 bucks will go in your way if you put them on your boat kind of thing?" Which, honestly, is probably way more valuable than whatever, like, you know, shit money he was going to give him later for finding out.
He was probably not even going to pay him. I don't know.
Probably not, because Curly doesn't look like a guy he's going to pay his
debts. He's like, "You know I'm good for it."
And all it resulted? Just giving his wife a shiner. That's... That $1,500 he, or I don't know, maybe back in the 40s, it might have been just like 75. Not to mention the fact the wife didn't look that smart either. So she just probably went out and, you know, fucked the first guy she saw. And that's...
We don't know the whole story.
We don't know how the story. And of course, that's part of the mystery of Chinatown.
Yeah, exactly. So which leads me to the next thing. I think the Cross character is definitely one of the most... What's the word?
Devious?
Well, I mean,
he's manipulative.
He's a monster.
He is a monster.
He's one of the biggest monsters on any noir. Actually, he is the epitome of the noir monster.
Rich, powerful, well connected.
Mm-hmm.
Not overtly dangerous. Because honestly, if you see an old man, you don't think anything's going to happen to him.
And he's been in politics, and he even says it himself. You know, I've been in politics long enough. People stop paying attention to you. You get the respect, I guess.
Yeah. Of course, I like the fact that, like, Jack Nicholson was asking, like, "How much are you worth?" "Oh, I don't know. Over $10 million? Oh, yes, $10 million. Like, what can you buy that that you can't already buy? Like, don't you eat well enough? Don't you dress well? Like, and he's like, the future, my boy. The future. You know, of course, that's when he's about to tell him this whole scheme for the water board.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a great scheme. It's you know, buying up all the
different water sources.
The different water sources, buying up the orange groves and, like, you know, getting... Of course, like, no one's going to care about the orange farmers. That guy's probably, like I said, he's probably, you know, kicking dudes out of their, other family or orchard farms. They've probably been out there for generations, probably.
Oh, quick side note.
What's up?
Maybe I just read into it too much, but there's the two guys that beat up Jack Nicholson in the orchards.
Mm-hmm.
One of them's kind of a little bit dumbwitted.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like that was kind of like a nod to, like, Grapes of Wrath. Because it's in the same...
Well, honestly, they're the same. That's... Well, that's pretty much the same period. That's, if anything, the Grapes of Wrath could have happened at the same time as... You know, because honestly, during the 40s... Well, no, I think the Grapes of Wrath happened during the 20s, right?
Maybe a little bit earlier, but I just think it was kind of funny.
You dumb okie. And honestly, yeah. That's exactly what happened, though. Like, yeah. You know, especially during the Dust Bowl... A lot of, you know, families came from Oklahoma just to escape the Dust Bowl to go into California.
Exactly, yeah.
I kind
of thought that was kind of cool. But yeah, going back to the water, yeah, it always reminds, when I watched, have you seen Rango?
Yeah, Rango, yeah.
So it, the actor, his last name is Houston. Is it John Houston?
Who played who?
Cross.
The turtle?
On the Chinatown.
Oh, yeah. John Hudson, I think.
Okay. Yeah. I thought it was Houston. But he resembles a turtle to me.
You know what? That...
And it's a water issue also.
Yeah, if anything... Yeah, you're right. It's a water issue. You know, he's an old turtle. Of course, granted... Especially in those desert types, you know, who controls the water controls everyone else.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what he's doing.
Yeah. I just thought that was
No, that's a really good...
A little nod there.
Because I love Rango. Rango's like just the...
Another underrated movie.
Yeah, another great movie.
Absolutely. So going back to the Cross character, the thing about it is that here's a guy who has everything, and on top of that, he still wants more. Now he wants to buy the future. You know what I mean? Like, honestly, he's never satisfied. I mean, does that have... The thing about these noir movies is they always talk about... I kind of feel like the message always has to do with us as human beings, our humanity. Mm-hmm. And how anybody in that position, if they're greedy enough, how much are they going to push it to?
Well, they often say that people in those high kind of corporate positions, I want to say it's like 1 out of 3 is a sociopath. But they often say they also they have trouble relating to, like, us. You know, of course, granted, it's kind of like I heard a joke the other day, and I thought it was actually, now that I think about it, it's really, really relevant. This guy was saying that his mom... said, yeah, billionaires are having meetings, and they're not, they won't let us into those meetings.
What you said in the last podcast.
Was it the last mm-hmm. podcast? Okay. And of course, they said, like, well, yeah, they're not going to let you in. What are you going to contribute? It's kind of like, a homeless guy going, like, yeah, like, you know, the regular people in regular homes, they have shoes and they have control of the shoes. Mm-hmm. You know, just, of course, a man. Like, you know, I guess Noah Cross, especially $10 million, they said over $10 million, now he would be kind of like a somewhat successful millionaire. Yeah. But back in the 1940s, that would have been unheard of. That guy is very powerful, very rich, in 1940 dollars especially. If anything, that's like racketeer money. That's Al Capone kind of money.
Yeah.
But of course, that's the thing about it. Like, once you have everything you can want, honestly, you're going to want more. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that's the reason why he's buying, you know, all the land. That's why he's, you know, the fact that, sure, like, you could have whatever you have now, but you could have the future. You could have there could be a bridge with your name on it. You know, that's and I can imagine that's what he wants, because especially with all that money, especially not even his money, the city's money. Because honestly, that's a bond issue.
Yeah.
But he's honestly going to be the one to profit off of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's, of course, granted, I don't want to get into, you know, social economic politics, about, you know, rich sociopaths. But yeah, of course, he's going to want to, like, you know, like I said, he's already had everything he wants. Imagine if you could buy the future. Like, yeah, of course. Of course he's going to do that. Why wouldn't he? He's probably bored. What's he going to do? Like, eat fish all day? Of course he's going to go try to, like, wrangle these poor orange farmers to, like, you know, build a, I don't know. No, he's not going to build a utopia, but he's definitely going to build, you know. And let's just talk about something else. I'm getting upset about it.
I can see what you're saying, because, I mean, a lot of the, to kind of compare that is with what was going on. I want to say, like, the early 1900s with the yellow journalism. It's kind of the same idea where people, you know, they figured out, you know, the power of media, you know, and which goes towards another great movie, Citizen Kane, that kind of exposed that. And then what happened with that? You know, he never made a movie that was that great again.
Orson Welles?
Yeah, he was blackballed a lot because they were scared, you know. They didn't want to be associated with him a lot of times. Which ended up making another noir movie called The Third Man, which is pretty good. We'll talk about that later. But it's about this guy on the run, and he throws some little political messages in there, and then runs away. But you could tell, I mean, that was really what he was at that time. He was like this man on the run. He challenged the media, you know. He challenged the power of this tycoon at the time. We won't get much into it, but it kind of mirrors what this is too, you know, art imitating life. But obviously with this movie, a couple things I wanted to kind of like showcase that I found out was that during this time, Roman Polanski kind of was going through a dark period of his time, and he had actually lost his wife.
Okay.
And she actually got killed by Charles Manson.
No shit, really?
Yeah. That was in L.A. And so he's doing this movie, Chinatown, in L.A., and he's taken a lot of these dark themes. And you got to understand, this guy's been through a lot, too. He's one of those guys that he has a lot of history and don't really want to get much about who he is, because he, in fact, I mean, you heard about what he did as well, right?
What, Charles Manson?
No. Roman Polanski.
No. That's kind of one of those things where, like, he's still on the run for his crimes.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
So it's, you know, without getting too much off track, here's a guy that basically knows evil, you could say, you know? And with this movie, this is, I mean, before that, this is a guy who first account knew about the Holocaust. You know, and then he deals with this death with his wife around the area that he's filming. So all these things are coming back. And in the original script, at the end of the movie, there was supposed to be a more of a happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
Cross was supposed to die. And instead we get a little bit different ending. We get a more realistic ending.
Do you want to spoil the ending, or do you just kind of want to just leave it on the up end?
Well, let's not mention it, but let's just talk about it.
All right. Okay. Because honestly, our first recording, we're just kind of like, all the spoilers. But now, just not, we not screw the movie up for anyone who watched the,
We'll not. But
40-year-old movie.
Yeah. the movie takes a really dark turn. A lot of the movie does within the script, because he kind of made it a little bit more darker, more cynical, I guess. Maybe, I don't know if that's the right word, but it was because of what he had felt through. You know, he had gone through a death, which is similar to what we kind of see at the very end of the movie. We kind of see this heartbreaking moment at the end of the movie. So it's not a happy-go-lucky fun ending. It's a dramatic one. It's a tragic one. And a lot of it has to do with what he was dealing with at the time.
Hmm.
So for me, it's one of the reasons why I really like this movie, because it kind of shows us as human beings the lengths that we can go, what we're capable of doing, which is the most scariest thing out of everything. Like, I could watch a slasher movie for whatever, for many reasons, right? But that's never going to be the horror of having all these things happen the way they happened in this movie. I'll just say it that way.
Okay, well, the difference between a horror slasher movie, you know, like a lot of characters are just, you know, two-dimensional. They're pretty much just fodder anyway.
Yeah.
And a lot of times you have to admit, though, it's just like it's a lot of it's very improbable.
Mm-hmm.
In Chinatown, that's very probable. It could probably happen today, really.
Yeah.
It's probably happening now if you really think about it.
Yeah.
But and that's maybe the worst. I would have to say that's – I wouldn't say the worst, but honestly – any movie that could actually be like, you know, this is completely possible. This is what could really happen. Of course, like I said, we like to talk about those issues of like the Twilight Zone and any kind of the ones. My favorite episode of the Twilight Zone are the ones that they don't have a weird supernatural ending. It's just reality, and just people are just animals. And this, it really hammers down to it. Like I think the last time we're recording, we kind of got into really the hard, dark aspects of the movie, but we're just like, no, that's a little, maybe it's a, it's a little too much, because honestly, we don't want to, our listeners are frail. We want to keep up their spirits. And granted, Chinatown's not really a, it's not one of those movies where you want to watch, and you're like, I feel better about that. You're like, oh, man, that's,
yeah.
Geez, I'm going to go call my mom or something. I don't know. Just to
well, the reason, because I can see why a lot of people don't really respond well to this movie. It's a hard movie to watch. For me, I kind of feel like it speaks in regards to individually the people. Well, how should I put it? Everybody has an inner good and an inner evil, and it's always kind of battling, and sometimes the evil overshadows the good, and that's what these noir movies tend to kind of showcase, is these people that they're normal people, and a normal person battles within themselves the evil inside and the good inside. It's always a struggle. The detective, like we talked about earlier, he's battling with it himself, you know, in the way, what he has to do to provide. And he's questioning himself, especially right after he gets done making love to the woman, right?
Yeah.
He's kind of questioning. He's like, you know what? I never know what's going on, because there's no real definitive good and evil. And I think this is what this movie's trying to say, is that there's never a definitive good and a definitive evil. There's always something in between. And what you see, it's not what you see a lot of times, like I said in the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, honestly, a lot of the characters that you see, the way they're presented at the beginning of the movie, they're actually almost the polar opposites with the other. You know, like Fade, in a way, she's supposed to be the strong heroine, and turns out she's just a frail kind of woman child.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Mulray, he's supposed to be like this lecherous old man, and turns out he's actually the best character. Norcross, like I said, is a monster. Mm-hmm. Like you just think he's a sweet old man, and just old country. How's it going?
Because it appears the first time he goes talk to him that his daughter is like this free go lucky. Killed her husband because,
you know, she was jealous. Obviously,
yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then turns out like no, that's
no,
not
it's very complicated. which we can end it on this note. I think this is a good note to end it on.
Yeah, because honestly, it's one of those movies where we could talk about it. And of course, the thing is, the more we talk about it, the more we're going to get at the source of ruining the movie for you. If you haven't watched it, like I said, 1974, watch it. You know, I want to say it's $3.99 on Amazon, which that's what I paid.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Of course, okay. Like I said, and I watched at work, and I watched that sex scene at work. And I was just like, oh, man. So I hope you appreciate. I almost got, you know, fired because I wanted to see Faye Dunaway's tits. Anyway.
So a lot of these movies have that duality, I guess you could say, especially with the water commissioner drowning. I mean, that's kind of...
In a desert, yeah.
Yeah, in a desert. But the one thing that I kind of thought was pretty funny this time watching it was that in the beginning of the movie, right before Jack Nicholson meets Morey,
okay,
Jack Nicholson's character, that is, he just got back from the barber and he hears this Chinese joke.
Which is not, it's not a great Chinese joke. No, it's not.
But he's excited.
Yeah.
And he clearly wants to tell his friends. So he goes in. It's a long joke. The payoff's not even worth it. But he goes on and on and tells a joke. To me, and they're always talking about Chinatown too. They're, you know, especially when he's talking to the detective. He's like, "Hey, are you still getting Chinese for spitting in the laundry?"
Yeah,
you know, things like that.
No, not since I became, because honestly, the fact that Chinatown, like, of course, granted. They could probably just made a movie on just the Chinatown itself, just to what happened at the dinner. Because honestly, like I said, it was most likely corrupt.
Yeah.
You know, they probably just ran poor Chinese people for just doing anything, just to get making revenue, basically.
Yeah, and then you actually see that because Cross employs a lot of them, too, because, you know, she's there, you know, putting up the furniture when he goes and try to see her.
James Hong is the butler.
Yeah, the butler. And then you have the old man in the grass who says, you know, bad for grass.
Yeah.
Bad for grass. And you find out it's the salt water that's killing the grass, and that's how he founds the glasses. But you can tell they're being exploited somehow. And it's all in Chinatown, which leads to the ending, which is the greatest line, I think, in the whole movie.
Forget about Jake. It's Chinatown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just very dismissive, very like...
Especially with everything that happened.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't matter. It's Chinatown. It doesn't matter what you do. It's Chinatown. You know, it's almost like, forget about Jake. It's life. You know, which
is, that's what he's saying with this movie. I mean, this, because Noir always speaks about these social qualms, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
And Chinatown is just us, really, as a society. That's really what I took from it. I don't know if you read into that, but I kind of feel like, you know, that's kind of what they said.
Okay.
It's kind of defeating sort of thing. Like,
it doesn't matter what you do. It's Chinatown.
Because you could try to do your best to, you know, to do what's right.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it's just going to just happen just because of circumstance. Like, it is what it is.
Yeah.
And that's the sad truth, you know? I guess.
Yeah, I guess it doesn't really said. It doesn't matter. It's Chinatown. And honestly, that's... I guess that's really life in general.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it goes there. It's one of those movies that put you in a funk. You know what I mean? You start thinking about your life. You start to seek introspection. Mainly because you realize that more than likely there are these horrors that live in our world today. Thank you for listening. This has been Classics at Josie's Cafe.